chance to talk about this work, which is actually going to appear on the archive tonight. So I thought it'd be a good time to present it here. I should mention this work is in collaboration with my students, Shubhayu Chatterjee and Alex Thompson and Matthias Scheuer, postdoc. And all three of them will be here at Perimeter later this summer, I think. All right, so the project is motivated by cuprate physics, and I'll even mention some experiments on cuprates a bit later. But let me just begin by presenting it as more of a theoretical problem of just thinking about interesting types of phases with topological order in two-dimensional spin systems. And so I'll begin by just introducing in a very basic way things that may be well known to some of you of what is topological order and why is it interesting experimentally and present it in some very simple, the simplest possible context really. And then the second part of my talk, I will use this topological order to do interesting things, to break symmetries, and most interestingly, of course, to get a pseudo gap. And this relates to various experiments in the cuprates. But let me begin by just a somewhat formal point of view, but just looking at a simple model. So the simplest model in which we can talk about topological order really is, it goes back all the way to 1971. It's this very simple Hamiltonian. It's the Z2 lattice gauge theory on a square lattice. So the degrees of freedom in today's language would be qubits. There's one qubit on every link of the square lattice. And the Hamiltonian is very simple. There's this Plaquette term, which is a product of tau z around the links. So tau z is the usual Pauli z operator. And a tau x term, which also acts on every link. So there's just one coupling constant g, and we ask what is the ground state of this Hamiltonian as a function of g. So this is the basic Z2 lattice gauge theory. Now, some of you may be familiar with more recent incarnation of a model with topological order, this famous toric code. This is richer than the toric code. It has one phase which is similar to the toric code, but also had other phases. So, and this is not exactly solvable. This is quite a non-trivial theory with a phase transition. All right, so let's just study this theory just on its face value as a function of this coupling constant g. So the first thing you notice when you, this theory is that there is an infinite set of conservation laws, or infinite set of commuting operators whose square is one, and these are these gi, which product of tau x on the four links that meet at a site, and it's easy to check that every gi commutes with the Hamiltonian. Okay, so this is basically why we call it a gauge theory, because there is a Gauss's law. That's what GI are, the Gauss's laws. So we have to fix the theory, we have to tell you what the values of the GI are. And for today, I'll just fix them to be one. Okay, so that's, now we've got fully defined the theory, we've fixed the gauge, and now we have to talk about its phases. So what Wegener already showed in 1971 is that there's two phases. There's a phase transition and there's a confinement-deconfinement transition, which Wegener described in terms of what are called Wilson loops, but perhaps they should be called Wegener loops because Wegener was before Wilson. And it's just the product of tau z on any contour on the lattice. So this operator does not commute with the Hamiltonian, but you can look at its expectation value. And what Wegener argued was that there were two possible behaviors of this expectation value as the loop became very large. There's a confining phase where you have the famous area law, and the deconfined phase where you have a perimeter law. And Wegener even gave a theory for the phase transition. So that's the way, this is, of course, had a huge impact on understanding of confinement in quantum chromodynamics and so on in one higher dimension. But I want to take a somewhat different point of view of thinking about these two phases and to really to characterize these phases somewhat differently. And the reason is that this is a, you know, beautiful criterion and shows there's no local order parameter. That's what Wegener emphasized. But this criterion fails if you change the theory a little bit. If you add what are called matter fields, or you add other degrees of freedom, this area law, perimeter law criterion doesn't tell you that there has to be a phase transition. This one, of course, tells you there's a phase transition when you change from area to perimeter in this theory, but it's not as robust. Okay, so we want to develop a more robust criterion for distinguishing confining and deconfined phases. This a nicer way to think about it, for my purposes anyway, is in terms of flux expulsion. So they have the Z2 gauge flux, which is this product of tau zero on any plaquette. And when G is very large, this term is not important, and this flux is fluctuating a lot. So effectively, the flux, the product on a plaquette will both be plus one and minus one randomly, and it's as if the gauge flux is condensed. On the other hand, when G is very small, you expect the flux to be all one to lower the energy, and occasionally there'll be some state with minus one, so this will be an excitation. So you will get these excitations with carrying flux minus one, which will move around the lattice. So really the property of the deconfined phase is one where flux is expelled, and you can get these excitations, these magnetic flux excitations with flux minus one, and these move around. So the reason we call this deconfined is you can't create, by any local operator, you can't create just one of these. If you flip any bond, you'll find you'll create a pair of them, plus one and minus one. But then the plus one and minus one can separate far away. And that's really what we should think about this phase. It's a phase where flux is expelled, and there are these magnetic flux particles. And these particles don't exist in the other phase. So that turns out to be a more robust way of thinking about distinguishing these two phases. All right. Yes.
Sorry, are you objecting to using the Wilson loops as a robust diagnose for the phase?
Well, I mean, in the pure gauge theory, it's fine. But if you suppose I take the gauge theory and add matter which at the Planck mass, then you can't use it anymore because you always get perimeter law.
But are you saying that there are no new Wilson loops that will do a good job?
Yeah, there aren't any. There are other criteria. There will still be a phase transition. You can put in heavy matter. There will still be a confinement-deconfinement transition, but you have to think about it differently. You can't use the Wilson loops.
Not even a modified version of them. So there are no such extended objects anymore.
Well, in a way there are. You have to put it on a torus. So you have to look at topological issues. Then you can distinguish it. So there are really what Wegener discovered was a topological phase and a topological phase transition, although he didn't use that language. So now let me take the same theory, the pure Ising gauge theory. So really, I'm still talking about this very simple Hamiltonian, and put it on a torus. So I put it on a torus. I told you already that there is an infinite set of conservation laws. All the g's are equal to one, and there's one g for every site of the lattice. But then you find when you put it on a torus, there's two more conservation laws. And that are these V's, the VX and the VY. And these are defined on these green contours that go on the dual lattice. And every time any link that intersects the dual lattice, you pick up a factor of tau X. Now, it doesn't matter which contour you choose as long as it wraps around the torus, because you can always multiply the V by a G and move the contour around, as you can easily check. So you just pick any one contour, the C bar Y and C bar X, two contours around the two cycles of the torus. And this you can also check also commutes with the Hamiltonian. So there's two additional conservation laws, which are VX and VY, which commute with the Hamiltonian. All right.
Did you have the Tooth operator?
Yes, correct. However, the Wilson lines, you can also now define two interesting Wilson lines. Just pick two contours on the direct lattice, the CX and the CY, and define the product of tau Z. Now, you can easily check that these four operators I've introduced obey this algebra. Vx and Wy anti-commute, and similarly with Vy and Wx, and everything else commutes. All right, but the important thing to remember is that Wx and Wy do not commute with the Hamiltonian. And that's the difference from the toric code, if you know what that is. Okay, so now in terms of these new operators on a torus, we can distinguish these two phases in a different way. And this is how you think about it. So in the confined phase, where G is very large, everything, all the spins point in the x direction. And if they all point in the x direction, so now we can ask, well, what are the eigenvalues of Vx and Vy? They commute with the Hamiltonian, so they have to have definite eigenvalue. So you can see if every spin in the x direction, Vx and Vy are just one. So there's only a unique ground state, and then there's gap. And the ground state has Vx equals 1 and Vy equals 1. On the other hand, on this side, as you go to a bigger and bigger torus, any finite torus, you will still find there's a unique ground state. But as you go to a bigger and bigger torus, you'll find that four states become nearly degenerate, exponentially fast, actually. And these are four states with Vx equals plus minus 1 and Vy equals plus minus 1. All right, so why does this happen? Well, one way to think about it is the following. Once you have these four states with Vx equals plus minus 1 and Vy equals plus minus 1, you can easily see from this algebra, and assume they're degenerate, that I can just take linear combination and make them eigenstates of Wx, the Wilson operators, plus minus 1 and Wy minus 1, just by a change of basis from the Pauli algebra. So now we have these four states, and I can think of these four states as states which have magnetic flux, minus 1 around the two cycles of the torus. So there's a Z2 flux around this cycle of the torus and the other cycle of the torus. This is the, and it's W is equal to plus or minus 1. Now remember, W doesn't commute with the Hamiltonian, so you don't expect the states to have definite flux. However, in a large enough system in the deconfined phase, they do. Basically, flux is expelled, and the only thing that remains is one flux quantum that can go through the whole of the torus, and for a large torus, that doesn't cost any energy. Okay, and so there's a four-fold degeneracy. So that's the more robust criterion for distinguishing the two phases. On one side, on a torus, there's only one state. On the other side, there's four states, and there's a phase transition between them. So this is a topological phase. This is not a topological phase. And today we even know that the low energy theory of this state is a topological quantum field theory. So it's a double Chern-Simons theory and all of that. So there's a much more sophisticated way of talking about this phase, but it only holds in this region. It doesn't hold here. And what this is that then is a topological phase transition where you lose the topological order. Okay? Any questions so far? All right. So now there's another way to think about this, which will be very useful for what I'm going to do. And this way it goes back to Fredkin and Schenker, who pointed out that you can get the same two phases using a U1 gauge theory. So now you have on the links of your lattice, I've written not the Hamiltonian, but the action in space-time. You have U1 gauge field AAA with components x, y, and time, at. And there's a Maxwell term, which is the flux through the plaquette, with one difference that there's a cosine. So that's why it's called a compact gauge theory, because it's cosine and flux 2 pi is invisible. Only, you know, flux is only measured modulo 2 pi. Now, to get the Z2 gauge theory, what I need to do is couple this. It's sort of very similar to a superconductor. I couple the gauge field to a Higgs field, or angle field theta, which has charge 2. Okay. Now, why is this like a Z2 gauge theory? Well, imagine that this term is really large, and we can fix a gauge where theta is 0. We can always do a gauge transformation to get rid of theta. So you get cosine of 2 mu, which means if this term is really large, mu is either 0 or pi. So now you see on each state, on each link, you have just two states, 0 or pi. And this term, then you can see, is basically nothing but is nothing but the same term, is the product of tau z's around a plaquette. So that's the rough argument why this compact U1 gauge theory with charge 2 scalar is the same as a Z2 gauge theory. So in this language, how do I distinguish the two phases? So in the confined phase, where G is very large, that just means the flux is fluctuating a lot, just like in the Z2 gauge, there are lots of flux fluctuations. And here, the way we say this is that the monopoles, which are point-like Dirac monopoles with flux 2 pi, they can proliferate. And that's the Polyakov mechanism for getting a deconfined phase in compact U1 gauge theory. On the other hand, in the deconfined phase, that's like a superconductor. In a superconductor, where this term is very important, what you have is, basically the gauge field is gapped, and the cosine theta term is very important, and there's a scalar field that's condensed of charge 2, just like in a superconductor. So you can think of theta as the phase of a Cooper pair. And then we know that when in a superconductor there's Meissner effect, flux is expelled. That's exactly what happens in the deconfined phase of a Z2 gauge. The flux is expelled. And you have vortices, you have average of vortices. Here the vortices carry flux pi. Well, flux pi of a vortex is the same as a Z2 flux of minus 1. Okay, so and so there are these vortices, Abrikov vortices, present over here. Now there's one very important difference from Abrikov vortices. You can get vortices in an ordinary superconductor that have flux pi, 2 pi, 3 pi, 4 pi, 5 pi, and they're all different vortices. They're distinguishable. They cost more and more energy. But here, there's only one vortex, it's pi. 2 pi is not a vortex because of the cosine term. 2 pi flux is invisible. Okay, so here flux is modulo 2 pi, but there's only one vortex. There's only a Z2 vortex. It's not a Zn vortex. It's not a Z vortex, it's a Z2 vortex. And that's exactly what happened in Z2 gauge theory. Okay, so what we learn is that you get the same phases of a Z2 gauge theory with topological order and no topological order in a superconductor where the gauge field is compact. So we can also, in the same theory, understand the topological order quite easily. So in the deconfined phase where phi, which is e to the I theta, is condensed, then you can get a vortex. The Abrikosov vortex can go through the whole of the torus. It'll cost no energy. And that has phase winding of phi by 2 pi. On the other hand, you could imagine that you had phase winding of phi by 4 pi or 6 pi or 8 pi, but that's not allowed because those are not distinct. Those are not distinct. That's allowed, but they're not distinct because the phi, the gauge flux inside, which will have flux pi, 2 pi, 3 pi, are only measured modulo 2 pi. So there's only one extra vortex state for each cycle of the torus, and that means the total degeneracy is 4, depending on, you put the vortex through one cycle, the other cycle, or both cycles. Okay? All right. So that's my conclusion of my review of some old work in the modern language of how the Z2 gauge theory, or equivalently U1 gauge theories with a Higgs field of charge 2, can have two phases. One is a non-topological phase, where flux fluctuates a lot, and the other is the topological phase where flux is expelled. The toric code describes only one phase, but they can also be phase transition. Toric code is a solvable model with stationary particles in one phase. This is a much more general and robust phenomena. Okay? Any questions?
So there are,
yes, go ahead.
So there is no edge state for the topological phase.
Right. So here, So I'm defining using the definition of topological order, which I guess goes back to Witten. Topological order has to do with multiple ground state degeneracy on a torus. So one of the unfortunate features of modern condensed matter is the famous topological insulator. It does not have topological order because it's a unique on the torus. So it's I'm very carefully using the word topological order, which should not be applied to topological insulators. Yes?
What about the entanglement structure? There's a way of defining topological order as long-range entanglement.
Yes. So that would work here too. Okay. Right. So that there will be this, I forget, the topological entanglement entropy of Preskill-Kitaev and Levin-Wen. So there will be a topological entropy here, but not here. Here it'll be zero, there's log two or something. So it's got degeneracy in a torus, it's got anion excitation. So I haven't told you about anions, so you can get, I showed you about the pi flux vortex, that's a boson, but you can also get electric charges, and then electric charges as they move around the pi flux give you a phase of pi. So that's like in the toric core, there's this pi flux, this thing here is just the M particle of the toric core. There's an E particle, which you can, this theory doesn't have an E particle, but you can put it in quite easily at above some gap. So, right. So it has all the features of it's. So if you compare it to, say, the fractional quantum Hall states, it's got anion statistics, it's got ground state degeneracy, it's got topological entanglement entropy, but it does not have edge states, at least generically. There are some versions of Z2 gauge theory you can define that do have edge states, but then that requires some symmetry to get edge states. On the other hand, topological insulators have edge states, but they don't have any of the other features. They do not have bulk anions, they do not have topological entanglement entropy in the bulk, and so on. So edge states are not a very sharp criterion. Okay. Any other questions? All right, so now let me go to use this for something else. So now it turns out, topological order is an interesting idea and it's got these exotic properties, but it can also be very useful to do things that would otherwise be not really reasonable. One of which, really most interestingly, which I hope to have time, is to violate the Luttinger theorem. You can use topological order to get metals that do not obey the Luttinger theorem. But I want to talk here about just breaking symmetry. So normally you would say, okay, symmetry breaking is boring. It's described by Landau theory. There's some order parameter. You write down some field theory for the order parameter and end of story. True, if you see a broken symmetry in an experiment, that's what you should assume. But what you find in many experiments is, especially in the cuprates, you see broken symmetries, like broken lattice rotation symmetry, inversion symmetry, time reversal, all kinds of experiments, seeing all kinds of broken symmetries. But you also see that when the broken symmetry disappears, lots of other things happen, like the pseudo gap disappears, like the Fermi surface changes. And then that you cannot understand from symmetry. If you're using only symmetry, and symmetry is king, then when symmetry disappears, nothing else should really happen other than the symmetry disappearing, loosely speaking. But if you now make symmetry kind of, I guess one word people are using, intertwine it with something else, then lots of interesting things can happen at the point where symmetry disappears. Okay, so let me show you how that works. So here, I'm going to start with the square lattice antiferromagnet, which everyone, we know from experiments and theory, has long-range Nail order. So this is a system with near-neighbor exchange interactions, spinner halves on the vertices of a square lattice, and the spins, it is believed, freeze into in the ground state in this checkerboard arrangement. So what I'm interested in is somehow tweaking this. So this is the picture you would get from a semi-classical analysis. Or large S or something. So now I want to put in some quantum fluctuations and ask, what are some of the states that are nearby? Okay, when you perturb this a little bit. So the usual theory of fluctuations of the state is the nonlinear sigma model. So you define some continuum order parameter N, which is the spin operator times eta I, this would be T not tau, eta I is plus minus 1 on the two sublattices. So in this state, n is just a constant. It's a constant unit vector. But then you allow it to fluctuate, and I guess Haldane showed that the long-lived fluctuations of antiferromagnets like this are given by the O3 nonlinear sigma model. Now, what will be useful for me is not this formulation, but another formulation, which is formally, at least in the continuum, exactly equivalent. You can take this theory and write n in terms of these spinner variables. So z are two complex numbers. Alpha, beta is up or down. So there's a two complex number at every point in space. And then you can just insert this in here and do some Hubbard-Stratonovich things, and what you get, amazingly, is a U1 gauge theory. So this is, I guess, goes back to the 70s, the work of Witten and Dada and Lucia and others, I think. Okay, so why is this a gauge theory? Well, you can already see that from here. If I change the phase of z by a overall factor, multiply z alpha by an overall phase, you can see that n doesn't change. So I can do a gauge transformation on z, and will not change n, and therefore will not change the energy. So any theory for the action must be gauge, or for z must be gauge invariant, and indeed that's what you find. So it's a U1 gauge field. Okay. Now, I'm going to work with this model, which is called the CP1 model, basically in the continuum for what I want to show. But there's a long history, which fortunately is not important for my purposes today, which all has to do with the fact that this is not quite correct in 2+1 dimensions. So there are corrections. There are kind of lattice effects that one really has to worry about very carefully. So there's a long saga of that, and it's all very well understood today, I believe. But let me just mention it, and then we don't have to worry about it too much. So it turns out this is not quite correct, because we also have to worry about monopoles in this gauge. Whenever you have a U1 gauge field, you have to worry about monopoles in 2+1 dimensions. And here, you do have to worry about it, because this is, in fact, a compact gauge theory, even though in the continuum it doesn't look compact. You're allowed to have monopoles on the lattice. And it turns out these monopoles have additional phase factors, which were first computed by Haldane, and which then we showed that these phase factors lead to what's called valence bond solid order. So if you now take the CP1 model and just turn up this coupling G, it has only one coupling G, which is something like the spin. So when G is very small, it's 1 over S. When G is very small, you're at a very large spin. When G is very, very large, then you're at spin a half. And here's just a continuum, so you can make it spin as small as you want. So when you turn up this coupling G, meaning you increase quantum fluctuations, you go from the nail state to this phase, which is a valence bond solid, where the spins form singlets and they crystallize in some arrangement. Okay. And there's a long story, which is in some sense still continuing, of the nature of this phase transition, which is a deconfined critical point. But none of this is important to what I want to do. So here I just want to say that neither of these phases has topological order. This is just an ordinary symmetry broken state. That's it. And this, you know, looks like a gauge theory because of described by the gauge field A mu, but the theory is confining because monopoles proliferate, and this is really more very much like the large G phase of the Z2 gauge theory. It's just totally confining. There's some additional subtleties with defects, but let's not worry about it. So what I want to do is to take this theory and get a deconfined phase, get topological order. Okay. So, of course, there's been a lot of work on that question. People have worked on all kinds of models of topological order in the square lattice. Xiaogang has a beautiful paper where he has 101 or something like that possible states of topological order in the square lattice. But what I want to ask a slightly different question. I want to ask, suppose I know that the low energy theory, I want to ask an energetic question, not a symmetry question. suppose I know the low energy theory is this theory, and that all the low energy important fluctuation are described by the CP1 model. And, you know, because that's what seems to fit a lot of the experiments and numerics and so on. So starting from the CP1 model and looking at using only its low energy modes, what can I do to get topological order? That's the question I'm going to ask. All right. So what we've learned from the first part of my talk is that the way you get topological order is you start, if you have a U1 gauge theory, you find a Higgs field of charge 2, and you condense it. And when you condense a Higgs field of charge 2, you will get a topological phase with this Z2 topological, or toric code topological order. All right, so let me look for that. All right, I have a field of charge 1, which is Z, which is this spin-on field Z. So let me make a field of charge 2. All right, so now I want to make a field that is spin rotation invariant. So it means I have to take the product of two Zs and get a spin singlet. Well, so the simplest singlet will be Z up, Z down, minus Z down, Z up. Unfortunately, because Z is a boson, that's 0. You can't make a spin singlet out of a boson in an S-wave state. So the best thing you can do is you've got to have these, there are two ways to make a singlet and charge 2 with only minimum number of gradients, because I want to only look at long wavelength effects. And that's, you have to put one time derivative or one space derivative. So I have three candidate Higgs fields, P's and Q's, or one P and two Q's. And so these are the simplest possible Higgs fields with charge 2 and spin rotation invariant. And if I condense these in the U1 gauge theory, then I know I'm going to get some interesting topological phases. So that's what I'm going to do, that's all. It's a very simple question, something I could have asked 20 years ago, but for reasons, mysterious reasons, I didn't. But it leads to very interesting answers, as I hope to convince you. So one thing you notice about this, these fields now, that although they are very simple as far as the gauge structure is concerned, there's something non-trivial about them in terms of inversion symmetries. So this one, if I take T to minus T, this P goes to minus P. Okay, there's some, you have to worry a little bit about the transformations of Z, but let me just ignore that. So it's clear that P will be odd under time reversal. So does that mean when I condense P, I'm going to break time reversal? Anybody have a guess? Suppose I go to a phase where I just condense P. Will that break time reversal? Okay, the answer is no, because P is not gauge invariant. P has gauge charge 2. So really, if you're breaking a symmetry, you have to have gauge invariant observables that are odd under that symmetry. So just condensing P will not break time reversal. But it does have these interesting time reversal properties that we have, that we have to keep track of. All right, so that's just a thing to keep in mind. So now I have the CP1 model that I showed you earlier. Then I add some theory for the P's and Q's, just using symmetry. So this is now it's charge 2. And then it can couple, this can cross-coupling between these two and cross-coupling between these two and some Landau theory. OK, many coupling constants floating around. But the three coupling constants I want to keep track of are G, S1. So when S1 turns negative, P will condense. And S2, when S2 turns condensed, negative, Q will condense. OK? So these are different charge 2 fields. So it's basically, you know, a dressed up version of the Z2 gauge theory I told you before, but now it's got many different matter fields and different symmetries, but it's the same phenomenology as the Z2 gauge theory I started with. So I have a three-dimensional phase diagram as a function of G, S1, and S2, and here it is. Okay, it's a bit busy.
The P's and Q's don't interact?
Yeah, you can have some quartic terms here. I haven't written them down. P squared, Q squared, and things like that. because they can't just put a PQ term, because then you will break rotational invariance and spatial invariance and so on. There are square lattice and time reversal symmetries that prohibit those things. All right, so this is a rather busy phase diagram, but let me just, for now, so this axis is like spin. So this is large spin, this is small spin. So this is semi-classical, this is very quantum. And the other two axes are something like frustration or ring exchange or something. So the two phases I've told you about are the Néel phase here, and below it was the valence bond solid. Now what I want to do, I want to start with this valence bond solid and show you what's happening here. So here's the valence bond solid, which is what you get in the usual CP1 model, or you know, in the JQ model. It's been studied a great deal by many people, very close to the Néel state. But now I want to frustrate this and get a deconfined phase. So the first thing you can do is to condense P. So when S1 becomes negative, you condense P. So this, just like in the Fredkin-Schenker picture, gives you a Z2 deconfined phase. Okay. So now here you have lots of other quantum numbers to worry about. You go in there and you analyze it. What is this Z2 confined phase? It's got topological order. And you analyze it and you find it breaks no symmetries. And the reason it doesn't break symmetries is, even though P is odd under time reversal, the only gauge invariant condensate I can write down is P squared. And P squared is certainly invariant under all symmetries, or mod P squared. Okay, so this is a completely symmetric spin liquid state with no broken symmetries. And that's exactly what many people have been worrying about. And in fact, Xiaogang gave a classification of possible states with Z2 topological order in the square lattice in a very different language, not even using the CP1 language. He was using SU2 gauge theories and God knows, and fermions. But for us, there was an approach using Schwinger bosons by Yang and Fa Wang, which is, in fact, after looking at their paper, we realize it's the same state. And what they also show is that this is, of the 101 states that Xiaogang wrote down, this is one of them. It's somewhere in there. One of them is exactly this state. So what we are saying, that one state is a good one to look at, because there are energetic reasons for it to be good, because it's near the Néel state. All others are really far away. You got to condense some more high energy fields. All right, so we've succeeded in finding a spin liquid with no broken symmetries on the square lattice, at least in this phenomenological sense. All right, so how about when you condense Q? Now something more interesting happens, and this is actually something we did already back in 91. So now there's Q has two components, X and Y. So again, you get a spin liquid, but that spin liquid breaks the symmetry, because now I can define these order parameters, mod qx squared minus mod qy squared, or this one. And these order parameters are gauge invariant. They're also invariant under translations and inversion and time reversal. But they're not invariant under rotations by 90 degrees of the lattice. And easy to see, one of these two has to be non-zero. So you must break lattice rotation by 90 degrees. So this is an example of what I call intertwining of topological order and broken symmetries. You're getting a certain topological phase with certain Higgs fields with certain quantum numbers. And out of those Higgs fields, you can make a gauge invariant object that breaks a global symmetry. So this topological order, I guess in some sense, is what we would call a symmetry enriched topological phase. It cannot exist without the broken symmetry. This particular flavor of topological, or this particular spin liquid, can only exist on a rectangular lattice. It cannot exist on a square lattice. But here you see this very easily just by this very simple argument. And so this is what you call Ising pneumatic order, meaning that if you look at charge correlations or any correlations, you know, or even the conductivity, if you dope the system, the conductivity in this direction would be different from the conductivity in that direction. Any property would be different in the two directions. So it has, it's a liquid crystal state which breaks 90 degree rotation symmetry. Now, it's an electronic liquid crystal in the language of Kivelson et al. Okay? So that's a novel type. So this, you know, these type of states are not in Xiaogang's paper because he just insisted on only looking at states that break no symmetries. And one of my points is that, you know, that's a good thing to do, but there's no physics reason, there's no energetic reason to do that. Energetically, maybe you do need to break a symmetry, and you can still get topological order. And finally, you know, what really was quite amazing to me, then there's a third phase down here, the pink region, where both P and Q are condensed, both of them condensed. And now there's another order parameter, which is the product of Q and P, which is gauge invariant. And this is also non-zero. And this guy, if you just go back and look, you notice that P was odd under time reversal and Q was odd under spatial inversion. So this thing is odd under either time reversal or spatial inversion, but not under their product. And it's even under translations that also you can see. So when you think about what is it that has these symmetries in terms of observable quantities, which is odd under time reversal, odd under reflection, but even under the product, and invariant under translations, those turn out to be these current loop states of Chandravarma. Actually, Chandravarma had a state with this symmetry. This is a different state that he didn't have. And these just come out. So you get a mod insulator in principle. A mod insulator can have currents flowing in loops forever, persistent currents. They're just flowing in tiny little loops, so they have some magnetic moments. This is a charged orbital magnetic moments. It will appear in some spatially uniform pattern in this phase. So that, and this just comes out by this, you know, this is not something we put in by hand. It just comes out by this criterion, the simple question we asked, which are the topological phases which are near the nail state? That's all we asked. And these are the three ones out of the, one of which was in Xiaogang's paper. This actually we had, and this is new. All right, so this is something very exciting to us because there's been a number of experiments which show exactly these two symmetries. Yeah, there's a whole zoo of literature in the past 20 years in the cuprates, in the doped system anyway, where some people claim there's nematic order, other people claim there's broken inversion, other people claim there's broken time reversal, in some combination of the other, and it's hard to keep track, but this is it. This is what people have claimed, exactly these two broken symmetry. So here's a recent beautiful work by David Shea on second harmonic light, which is sensitive to inversion symmetry breaking in doped YVCO, where as you lower the temperature, at certain temperature, you see this very clean onset, which you can relate to breaking of inversion symmetry. And the onset as a function of density is here. And then there's many different experiments he's shown. There's the Kerr effect, there's neutron scattering, which is also along the same line. That measures time reversal symmetry breaking. The Nernst effect measures pneumatic order. Resonant ultrasound is not clear what it measures, just sees a phase transition. The only thing that doesn't follow this line, this famous pseudo-gap line, is the charge density wave order, which clearly, that breaks translational symmetry, and I'm not allowing that to happen. That doesn't seem to be tied to the pseudo-gap. Okay. All right. So that's the main new result, how topological phases near the nail state actually seem to have exactly the same broken symmetries that you see in the experiments. That doesn't mean they explain the experiments, but it's enough to get me excited anyway. Yes.
So do they need the P squared, Q squared, the coupling term to get the P not equal to 0, Q not equal to 0 phase?
No. If you have both S1 and S2 negative, they will both condense. Now, the coupling term may change so the coupling term will choose between this or this. So one, both S1 and S2 are negative, they will both condense. But then exactly how they condense relative to each other will choose between these two. Yeah.
Yeah. This analysis is very far away from the phase transition, right?
Which phase transition?
Between the confined, what you were calling before.
Well, so if you wish, there's four phases here and four phases here. And then one that phase transition is this line. So there's a multi-critical point where eight phases meet. Mm-hmm. And I'm just talking about all the eight phases near that multi-critical point. Yeah, so the deconfined phase transition is between this and this. So I imagine I come down and just reach this, and then I go in these two directions. So maybe, you know, in reality I'm somewhere here, and then I'm just going diagonally down. Okay. Yeah.
Can you explain a bit more about how the experiments confirm that the two topological order?
Oh, the experiments don't know about the two topological. Okay. Absolutely. So what the experiments measure is inversion symmetry breaking. That's it.
Yeah. Like,
okay.
How does that confirm any of those two
phases? Oh, yeah, it doesn't. Good point. Thank you. That's the remainder part of my talk. So what is also known is that if you measure spectroscopic properties, if you measure photo emission, or you look at this experimental spectrum in the antinodes, there's a pseudo gap. People call this mysterious pseudo gap, which is seen very beautifully in so many experiments. What you find is that along this line is also where the pseudo gap disappears. So there's a gap in some electronic spectrum, and that disappears along the same line. Now, if I said, which, roughly speaking, is Chandra Varma's or Kivelson's point of view, that this is just a broken symmetry. That's it. And Landau theory should describe it. Well, I shouldn't say. OK, I'm not sure what their point of view is. Let me just say it. The simple point of view, which they may not ascribe to, is that this is just broken symmetry. And so if this is broken symmetry, then at the point where the symmetry is restored on this side, there's no reason, it doesn't care whether there's a pseudo gap or not. It's just a broken symmetry. This broken symmetry does not induce a pseudo gap. And reason being that because of Luttinger's theorem. So all of these broken symmetries preserve translational symmetry. So as long as you have translational symmetry, Luttinger's theorem says you must have a large Fermi surface, i.e. no pseudo gap. So these symmetries are blind to existence or non-existence of a pseudo gap. So I'm saying these are not just symmetry, these are slave to underlying topological order. What's really happening is loss of topological order. And as you lose the topological order, you also lose the symmetry. That's just a side phenomenon. But as you lose the topological order, you lose the pseudo gap.
Why is that?
That's the next part of my talk. Well, excellent question. Yeah.
So how do you get this microscopically? What do you have to add to the
high-level model? I don't have a site on that. So what we have done is analyze the semi-classical limit, where we can do a pretty complete analysis. And there we find you need a J1, J2, J3, and a ring exchange. A ring exchange is crucial, actually, to get the inversion and time reversal symmetry breaking. How large, we don't know, but you know, in the semi-classical limit, if they're about half or smaller than the nearest neighbor exchange, it's already enough to give you all these phases. So I'm hoping that people will study this numerically. But the ring exchange seems to be crucial. Yeah. People have studied J1, J2, J3 models, but ring exchange has not been studied as much, very few studies. All right. Let me also just mention, yeah.
In a triangular lattice, right, the ring exchange is the pathway to go back to the metallic phase, perhaps through a spin liquid, right? But here.
This is a square lattice.
This is a square lattice.
Yeah. So let me just show you explicit diagrams, actually. So you can then ask what happens at large, at small g or large s. There you get magnetic order. And these are the magnetically ordered phases. Here's a nail phase. And with these expectation values, there's a canted phase and a spiral phase and a canted spiral. This is what comes out of the CP1 analysis. So you know, these seem like random states. But if you take the model with J1, J2, J3, J4, and ring exchange, you get exactly these phases and nothing more, classically. And they all meet at one point, just like this point here. There's the same point here. And so this phase here is this phase here, which is a canted spiral. So what this means, the spins are spiraling on the base of a cone. That's a canted spiral. This is just ordinary canting. This is a planar spiral. So these two have ferromagnetic moments. This one doesn't have a ferromagnetic moment. These are the ordered states. So my claim is that if you're somewhere over here semi-classically, and then you break, then you restore spin rotation invariance by going to small spin, you will get a state with loop currents. So this is all a semi-classical analysis, and in the semi-classical limit, these are the only phases, there's nothing else. Because you can look for all possible phases with near-neighbor couplings. So, you know, again, this whole analysis may seem arbitrary, but it's well designed to completely capture the physics of the semi-classical limit. I mean, it misses many, many exotic spin liquid phases, but those are who knows where in parameter space. These are the ones that are nearest to the nail states. Okay.
If you go back to the fermion problem that would have given you this Hamiltonian, right?
Yeah.
You went to that regime.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at the current operators, there's no current in that purple phase, like
here.
Yeah.
Well, there will be a current phase in the Hubbard model.
Right.
Not yeah. So of course, in the spin model, there's no current.
Yeah.
If you go back to the Hubbard model, yes. So in this phase, there will be currents. We had another paper showing that already. Yeah. So the operator that corresponds to current is, if you know,
so
one of the
three spin operators.
Well, it's so easy to think in terms of when you have an antiferromagnet, there's a staggered magnetization, let's call it N, and there's a uniform magnetization, let's call it L. So the current loop operator with the same symmetry as the current loop is L dot N cross grad N. and that's the operator. You need to be non-zero to get currents in loops. In these Varma loops. Okay, so this is another amazing experiment in strontium iridate, which has believed to be also described by the square lattice antiferromagnet. And what they see again is the same inversion symmetry breaking already even in the insulator. So maybe strontium iridate is different from the cuprates, but in this case, it suggests that maybe topological order is present even in the insulator, which would be quite amazing. Okay. All right, so let me ask, I have 5 minutes left. Let me very quickly try to describe why topological order implies a pseudo gap. Okay, so this is old work. There's many ways of seeing it. I'll show you in one possible way. There's even a theorem that one can prove that topological order is required to violate the Luttinger theorem. Yes, I understand there's a faculty meeting, but look, let me quickly go through this. So you start with a square lattice antiferromagnet, and you remove some electrons, density P. Okay, now this, let's imagine this is a metal. When these things move around, you get a metallic state. Now what can I say about that metal? Well, this metal, even though it looks like it has P holes, actually relative to the filled band, which is this state, because you can put two electrons on each side, it really has 1+ p holes. But there's one hole on every side. Therefore, Luttinger's theorem says is that the volume enclosed by the Fermi surface should be 1+p. Okay. And that's what's seen in the overdoped regime. However, so let me now show you how with topological order you can get p, not 1+p. So we start with this famous spin fermion model. You take electrons hopping on the square lattice, and you couple them to some antiferromagnetic order parameter, phi. This is exactly the model you work with. Okay, so if you have just this model, you have a large Fermi surface of size 1+p. Now imagine you have in the anti-ferromagnetic phase where phi is constant. When phi is constant, you get small pockets of size p. But this is okay because phi has broken a translational symmetry. And so if you just work through the Luttinger theorem for translational symmetry breaking, you can get small Fermi surface. So this has a pseudo gap, but also breaks translation. And there's no sign of translational symmetry breaking in the experiments near the onset of the pseudo gap. So this can't be the explanation for the pseudo gap. So the question we want to ask is, and this phase transition, which Peter, as the world's expert, has, may well describe between the anti-Fermi metal and the Fermi liquid, maybe the ion-based materials. But the question is, can we get a state which has no broken translational symmetry, but a small Fermi surface? The answer is yes, but you need topological order. Now let me show how you would do it. One way of doing it is the following. I'm rushing, but it's really a very simple argument. Use the idea of going a rotating reference frame. So you take your electrons, and you write them in some new fermions. I'm calling them chargeons here, the psi fermions, which are related by some SU2 rotation. So the idea here is that you have some anti-ferromagnetic order, which is fluctuating from point to point. And at every point in space, I'm just going to rotate my axis so that my z-axis is along the local order. That's what I want to do. Right, so if you give me some anti-ferromagnetic order, I'm going to rotate my axis to make it z, whatever z is locally. That's what this r will do. And how do I rotate the order? By this kind of transformation, r and r dagger. So the rotated order is this field h, which I'm going to call a Higgs field. So what I want to do in doing this is to make h constant. So h is phi is fluctuating. I'm in some fluctuating antiferromagnet. I want to make h constant. And the question is, can I find r's to make h constant? OK, that's the question I want to ask. Well, one thing you notice immediately, and this is why I call this a Higgs field, whatever r you find is not unique. I can always multiply psi by some SU2 matrix V, and R by V dagger, and the Higgs field by V V dagger, and nothing changes. Everything remains the same. So the Higgs field is gauge dependent. R is gauge dependent, but the electrons are not, of course. So I can always find a Higgs field, or at least I claim, I hope to find a Higgs field, which is a constant for any phi you give me. That's what I want to do. All right, so suppose I succeeded in doing that. If I succeed in doing that, then these new fermions will have some hopping matrix element, the same band structures. But now these new fermions will see a constant Higgs field. And therefore, I'm done. I've got a pseudo gap. I have a constant Higgs field. And the new fermions have the same band structure as the old fermions in the presence of antiferromagnetic order. And I have a small Fermi surface, I have a pseudo gap. End of story. It sounds too easy, right? So yeah. So what I'm telling you, it doesn't matter if you have a rotating reference frame, you can just gauge away the antiferromagnetism, and ta-da, in the new fermions, which are rotating locally, you have small Fermi surfaces. OK. It is too easy. There's something wrong with that argument. What's wrong with the argument? What's wrong with the argument is this fails near a vortex. Suppose my antiferromagnetic order has a vortex. So it has winding. So this is some unique antiferromagnetic configuration. Since it's fluctuating, I will have vortices. They're floating around everywhere. So my R, as I go around, you know, if I rotate a spin by 2 pi, the SC2 matrix R goes to minus R, the famous minus 1 factor of a spin a half. So for a vortex, I cannot do this. I cannot find a R, which will be single valued. If you have even one vortex in your sample, you're cooked. You cannot get rid of the antiferromagnetic order by going to a rotating reference frame, because your R is not single valued. So what do you have to do? Well, what you have to do is go to some phase where antiferromagnetic is fluctuating, but you don't have any vortices. Well, that sounds too strong. I mean, if you didn't have any vortices, maybe you still have long-range order. So what you actually have to do is you don't have any single vortices. you can have double vortices. So if you have a double vortex, fine, R will go back to R. Suppose you had fluctuating antiferromagnetism, where you had double vortices but not single vortices. Then in that fluctuating antiferromagnetism, I can define a new fermion which has a small Fermi surface. But so what we are suppressing, we are expelling vortices which have odd vorticity, not even vorticity, which is very, very similar to the beginning of my talk of getting rid of Z2 vortices. So the deconfined phase, which expels Z2 flux, is very analogous to that here. You have some more formal way of saying it is the Higgs field belongs to SO3, and you have to, since you're breaking SU2 down to SO3, there's an SU2 gauge, a Z2 gauge field left over, and there's a Z2 deconfined phase where you can violate the Leidener theorem. Okay, so that's the basic idea. And so now this phase transition in this new language is a language where you go from a Higgs field non-zero to Higgs field zero in the presence of some fixed R. But now there can be deconfined phases, and you have this new metal which has no broken symmetry but Z2 topological order, at least no broken translational symmetry. And so our proposal of what happens in the cuprates is actually you go like this. And this is the pseudo-gap phase, and these eventually become superconducting. And this is our theory of ITZ. Okay, all right. So I'm done, just 1-2 minutes over. So basically I gave you a simple example of Z2 topological order. A basic phenomenon is just expelling this flux, pi flux, you just get rid of it. And when you do that, you get this topologically ordered phase. And when you get rid of it in more realistic models, you get a pseudo gap, you get symmetry breaking, and many things that look very much like what's seen in the cuprates. So, thanks.
Questions? So why didn't you think of this before? You had the Q's and P's in your, early 90s paper.
No, we had the Q's, not the P's.
I see.
I don't know. I mean, well, I think the experiments are also, David Shea's experiments are very recent. But sure. And this goes back at least 10 years, this kind of thing. I think they finally cleaned up the language. We've been working on this kind of phase diagram for quite a while. What I should have thought about in the 90s is the P's in addition to the Q's. I didn't know about this phase. Working backwards from some more complicated models, Shubhayu and I realized this phase was there. And then we looked up Fa Wang's paper, and he had found it too, this 2016. So that's only last year. Once we knew about this phase, then everything fell in place. And then we said, oh, there's a P. I was giving talks in the old days that if you start from the nail state, if you want to get a Z2 spin liquid, then you must break lattice rotation symmetry, because I only found this. I was wrong. There's another one here, which I overlooked. So, I think, why did I overlook that? Well, so the way we found these was by Schwinger boson theory. And finding this condensate in the Schwinger boson theory is more complicated. In fact, if you just do unrestricted Hartree-Fock, you don't find it. But it's allowed by symmetry. So when you do the careful PSG analysis, which is what Wang did, they found this thing. Although to find it energetically, in the mean field, Schwinger boson theory is a little bit complicated.
Because you have to assume time dependence.
No, you have both B-dagger, and B-dagger, B-condensates. You have multiple condensates, and then when you do unrestricted Hartree-Fock without maintaining the constraint exactly, you find runaway flow. The whole thing becomes unstable. But it's an artifact of not imposing the constraint, of course. and we're still struggling with that right now to find the phase diagram. But it's no question, it's an allowed stable phase. You can see that from this field theory and other things. Yeah, so if you just turn the crank and look for this phase P, this Fa Wang's phase, you don't find it. But if you do a symmetry analysis, then you find it. And then we realize it must be there from a more general thing. Yeah, so, yeah, but we should have, I should have found this in 91. I should have, if I'd been smarter. Yeah.
When you decompose the spin vector initially using the CP1 build-on,
yes.
Could you have done it with fermions? Just decompose it.
So that's what Alex is working on. So we will, and it actually works, but it's work in progress.
So what the starting point is actually this recent paper of Wang, Senthil et al. So this is the CP1 theory. The Wang, Senthil et al. Have a fermionic dual of it, which turns out to be the pi flux SE2 gauge theory with fermions. That's this line. It is described by fermionic theory, which is now known what it is. It's also one of Shaogang's SE2 gauge fields. And so now we can start from the fermionic theory. And then reproduce the same phase diagram. And looks like it's working. I mean, still details working out for that.
The operators that condense, I guess.
They look different, but they, if you look at the physical symmetries and you look at the PSG of the spin-ons, they are identical. So this is all very recent stuff. I mean, we couldn't have done this in the 90s. All this technology for relating fermionic, Schwinger fermions to Schwinger bosons, that's only about 2 or 3 years old, how that developed. And these dualities are completely new. And so using that, it seems to fit very nicely. Well, tentatively, it's looking promising, I should say. And Alex will be here next month, and hopefully by then it'll all be worked out, so she can tell you more.
Is it possible to include lattice dynamics in the lattice gauge theory, and what will be the consequences?
Sorry?
What will the consequence of lattice dynamics and
you mean phonons?
Yes.
You want to talk about phonons?
Phonon has been interaction.
I don't know. I mean, they're not essential to anything. I mean, I'm just assuming the phonons can be integrated out at the expense of renormalizing the exchange constants. You know, this is sometimes called the spin pyrals phase, where pyrals gave an argument in 1D why you should get this order because of coupling to phonons. But we are assuming you get these things by spin frustration. But I mean, in principle, phonons could certainly help or hinder some of these phases, we don't know. But it won't change any of the topological or the symmetry analysis. That'll all remain the same. Yeah.
So how do you see that what's the microscopic mechanism to drive that phase? Starting from even a three-band Hubbard model.
The current loop phase, for example?
Well, the...
This phase?
Well, what's on the other side of the...
On the topologically ordered side of the phase. Like you had the...
Yeah, well, I mean...
For the cuprate, I mean.
So the cuprate phase diagram was up here, I guess. Yeah, so the idea is that if you're on, say, a nictide or even the electron doped cuprates, you just go from an anti-fermionic metal to a large Fermi surface, and you get TC here. All right. Now, what seems to be happening in the whole doped cuprates, you're actually making a detour. And before you get to the large Fermi surface state, you have the pseudo gap. So this is the pseudo gap phase, where you have topological order, but you don't have magnetism, and you have these broken inversion and time reversal symmetries, and you have small Fermi pockets. So you have a pseudo gap. So why are you going this way as opposed to going this way? I mean, that's what I would interpret your question. I don't really know. I mean, we know that the only difference between electron dope and hole dope is the sine of T2. And it seems like the electron dope is certainly more frustrated. The nail order doesn't last very long. It seems to go into the spin liquid pseudo gap phase much more readily. But microscopically, I think it's some combination of the sine of T2, you know, J2 is frustrated, and the ring exchange that brings you down here. That would be my guess. And then this phase transition here is the optimal doping phase transition that, this point here, Where did it go? Is this point over here?
I guess I'm missing the connection between the spin picture and yeah. J1, J2, J3, and the ring term.
Yeah.
The discussion in the dope phase.
Yeah. Well, we haven't given. Yeah. So I gave you two different theories.
Right, okay.
The theory that's where we can have a microscopic connection is way down here. Right. Is the insulator. Okay. Then I gave you this theory of like a souped-up Hertzsimmelius theory. I start with Hertzsimmelius theory, and then I say, okay, I go to rotating reference frame, write on a Gibbs field, and so on. So that's, I'm just pulling out of a hat. What I'm trying to do, which is what, you know, this is, in fact, this is how it started. I had a paper in 2009 where I finally understood this is the way to do it. You start from the Hertz theory, you go to rotating reference frame, and then when you take the insulating limit of this, you can see the same topological orders that you saw in the Schwinger boson theory. So this is, I mean, it's a phenomenon, you know. In other words, you write down some Higgs potential for phi, and that Higgs potential has to be chosen correctly so that you get the right topological order when you go to the insulating limit. But I certainly don't have a microscopic connection on how to do that here.
So
that's too hard.
This Higgs field is following the anti-formulaic
end
vector.
Yes.
Would it matter if you got out of a spin last phase instead of a nail phase? Or would the same kind of... Because it seems to be the crucial part is we have this charge two.
In principle, even the spin glass phase can get you a... You can get a... the topological order can also be present in disordered systems, yeah. In fact, it helps because what you really need, something I didn't carefully explain, you need some non-collinearity in the spins
right.
to get an SO3 Higgs field. So canting is fine, spiral cant or spiral is fine, or both, or spin glass even, as long as non-collinear. And then a melted spin glass could have Z2 topological order, yes. Absolutely.
There are no further questions. Thanks to me again.
Thank you.